And then finally you come to the question, what if, and I think Jim was leading toward this, what if, despite your best efforts, the actual revolution erupts, or some type of revolution? Then it seems that the Christian has to ask himself some very agonizing questions, because you come to the point of realizing that to do nothing is to make a decision here too. And whether you actually throw your support behind the revolution or not will be a terrifically difficult question. It's certainly one, I think, from which most of us would shrink unless we really felt extremely pressed. And yet, I think the one thing that we can say is that despite what happens, the Christian in the role of ultimate reconciler is always there.
Dean Wagner.
We try another approach to pressing Gary Cornish's question home. Jim mentioned that revolution may be inevitable, and then the question is, how do I exercise my Christian presence under such circumstances? Why do you even ask that question? For what purpose do you want to exercise a Christian presence?
I'm not sure I understand completely. Let me react and then you can clarify it. I suppose by Christian presence, I'm thinking of how, thinking of not only myself, but of these Christians who are caught up in this situation. How will we continue to bring the witness of Christ to this particular situation, which seems so apocalyptic, I guess. I don't know that answer. I suppose it's simply, how can I remain an authentic Christian who neither runs from the situation in whatever form it may take, and yet conversely am really a Christian and not just a part of the of what's happening. I don't know that answer.
Well, you speak of bringing the witness of Christ to this situation. Tell us, why? On the basis of what kind of mandate and what kind of goal in life?
I suppose the only mandate is the sense that that as Christ says, you are my witnesses, and I wish to be able in this context to be able to somehow reflect Christ's will in this particular situation. I think that would be the only real goal that I would have. I suppose that could be a self-justifying thing, therefore would be a very poor one. But seeking to be authentically Christian in a context that is foreign to my way of understanding.
I don't respond as quickly. I would say it would be because humanity, certainly a large portion of humanity caught up in a revolutionary situation would be suffering humanity. It would be in tremendous need. It would be identified with the Christ of the last, of the parable of the last judgment. You would have hunger and need for all of these, for healing of the wounds. And there would also be the whole question of the pursuit of justice here. The mandate from the prophets, from the letter of James, from, I think, the example of the ministry of Jesus, all of this would be motivation for involvement.
Mr. Danker. I don't have any trouble seeing Willis Lutheran answering every word that I submit. The other households and other channels that we have this point. For example, if I make a practical observation, for example, the Pharisees go around the long road, just I don't remember that about Luke. And if I talk, it's just to say addressed to a conference or something, and you talk about the garments you like to parade in, et cetera, and the nightgowns and whatnot, and all that, and stuff like that. Well, this suddenly gets too personal. The same thing applies when you start to talk about the, put the word establishment in Luke's gospel, or hierarchy. See? Then, oh no, this has to be a more objective reporting. In other words, it's content, we're content to be archaeologists and cremators and preservers in the liturgical and ecclesiastical urns of the relics of the saints and of all other things sanctified. And we say, for example, verbal insinuation, and we don't really believe what the words are, because if we did, we'd see how revolutionary they are.
I think in response to that, too, I think the thing that a lot of people have a mistaken idea that revolutionaries on campus are sort of born and that they, you know, that they develop like this ever since they received their permissive childhood training from Dr. Spock and from their parents. I don't think this is true. I find a lot of the people that were involved in the movements that I saw at Stanford, some of them were people from my own teaching assistant classes. They were the most intelligent, the most vital, and the most interested, and the most socially aware and concerned people that I saw on campus. They certainly weren't the dropouts and the people who didn't care what happened to them or who were on drugs or who didn't give a darn about society. I find a lot of people who become involved in these movements sort of at maybe a crucial point in their life when they begin asking questions about what their life means. They find that doing it on your own, making straight A's, achieving your niche in society as a lawyer or some other executive isn't enough. And they want something more. And a lot of times this will take sort of a social commitment. And then when they begin to see the injustices in society, and they see how some of these are reflected in the university setting, which is not always a very democratic place either, because education by definition is a very hierarchical, structured kind of thing, at least in our Western world. I think it's the frustration at trying to move through the system, perhaps with a lot of the dissatisfaction with the war, certainly a short time fuse, and you feel that the bomb is going to explode any minute. You may not have more than 10 or 15 years, if that long, before everything blows up and goes bluey. Certainly you're going to be a lot more ready for some kind of activist stance than if you feel you have a lot of time and the system is working and you have only to act in a rational, calm manner and things will happen. And the feeling among a lot of students is these problems are so great and so pressing, and they feel that they see them, and they're appalled by the fact that other people aren't equally disturbed about Vietnam. Like Life magazine finally this week published a list of the pictures of all the people that died in 1 week. Well, this is the kind of thing that the students have felt, you know, in a really deep way for a long time. They're the ones who have to face the draft, which seems to be run by General Hershey and a lot of old people who send these younger people out to die in Vietnam. And when you look at it that way, it's very hard to look at the establishment or the system without a feeling of raw anger. And I think this is why you have then a development. And a lot of people did not begin with the idea of we're going out to destroy society. I think you do it out of frustration as people in the ghetto, when you find that everything else you've tried simply doesn't seem to work. I'd like to give you an example of what the students were putting out during the sit-in. And this is supposedly a conversation that happened when they went to a Stanford trustee and they knocked on the front door and Dean Watkins opened it and the following conversation ensued. Student, Mr. Watkins, we'd like to talk to you. Watkins, are you involved in the sit-in? The answer, yes, we are. I'm not going to talk to you. Student asked, are you afraid? Watkins, I'm not afraid of anything. Student, why won't you talk to us then? Watkins, I'm not going to talk to you until you clear out of the building and start acting like adult, civilized human beings. Student, but some adult, civilized human beings act like, Watkins slams the door. Student, to a closed door, Thanks for the rational dialogue.
Okay. Next. During the pause, let me help the silence with a question of my own. Some social scientists who have concerned themselves with the social phenomenon of revolution have begun to revise a traditional theory of revolution. Whereas formerly, the dynamic components that were thought to be requisite for a revolution were simply oppressors and oppressed. Some of the revisionists have suggested that you need more than frustrated, oppressed people. That you might have, for example, in the case of the American Indian. That in addition to this, you need the additional component of some expectation of success. Now, I'd like to ask our panelists whether they've seen any evidence of this ingredient among those folks whom they've called revolutionaries.
Yes, I think there's an amazing self-confidence, assurance on the part of those who are involved in some of the movements. I think this begins with a type of high-level idealism, which I personally think is sometimes becomes naive and unrealistic in terms of the actual power structures and the real situation, but some of the youth that I had in classes at Berkeley and Santa Cruz in the winter and spring quarters of, I would estimate are probably 70% radical and maybe 15% committed to outright revolutionary change. They really are confident that somehow the future will bring about the changes that they anticipate, that success is assured, this is the wave of the future, that capitalism is doomed, that our society, and this is on part of some of them, that our society is so decadent, so corrupt, that its dissolution is inevitable, and it only remains for this to be more fully recognized, for the anger to be more fully aroused on the part of the oppressed.
Yeah, I could give maybe one example of this kind of confidence, too. There's a little song that they were handing out at the sit-in called It Is Nice. And one of the verses goes, it isn't nice to block the doorway. It isn't nice to go to jail. There are nicer ways to do it, but the nice ways always fail. It isn't nice. It isn't nice. You've told us once. You've told us twice. But if that's freedom's price, we don't mind. No, no, no. And then they go on to talk about the trustees and nerve gas and other things. And I guess pretty biting.
I should add one postscript, Bob, to make, I think, this a little bit more of a complete report. I would also be cognizant in the total situation of there being some students who, as I hear them, seem to be saying that we're not at all sure that ultimately we will be successful, but we believe that we may as well be involved and we may as well try. Exert ourselves to the fullest extent possible, because it can't. Whatever should result can't possibly be any worse than what we have now, or where our society is heading without this kind of revolutionary change.
Yes, please.
In John Constable's part this morning, we were talking about the abolition during the Civil War, and their press for abolition of slavery, and his contention was that the abolitionists were really wrong in one respect, that they had no plan for Reconstruction. They had no plan for the Negro after they achieved the purpose of obliterating slavery. You alluded to the fact that there is some plan after this society caved in the area of Yugoslavia or Czechoslovakia, some of these other possibilities or alternatives. Do you men pick up any more plans? This is what frightens me, I'd say. And maybe, too, what I can maybe grab hold of for the church. you know, is that maybe our job right now is, if we were like, and I would agree with you, my cohort and classmates, that we, I smell revolution on the horizon too. And then maybe our job is plan for the reconstruction. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on this? What's the plan?
Well, I might just say that this is repeatedly the question that arises as there's an attempt to communicate between, I think, the adult world or the administrators or the critics with the leaders of student movements. But I recall the panel that they had on the British Broadcasting Company last summer, in which they had assembled all of the chief leaders of revolt student movements in the different European countries. And this question was raised by the moderator, and he kept pressing it. And the student leaders were extremely resentful of it. And their attitude seemed to be this, that we cannot be expected to come up with a blueprint for the future. This is no excuse for not challenging the existing system, or for even on the part of some of those with the more revolutionary sentiments, bring it crumbling down, because it is impossible, really, in their judgment, to analyze or to be perceptive enough to look into the future and see exactly what this emerging society is going to be like and what its precise needs are going to be. They will simply speak in general terms, saying that we need an alternative to both of the super colossal world powers, to both the system of Moscow and of Washington, D.C. And I think some are ready to suggest that a possible model was in the making under the Dubček reforms in Czechoslovakia, that it would be some type of socialism with freedom, with a human face, the other word that's used, that socialism with a human face, that is, socialism without extreme totalitarian control, is the kind of vision that they have for the future. But they acknowledge, most of them, I think, that they have no specifics which to offer for implementation.
Pastor Reduce?
I'd like to respond to that just on the university level. I think maybe for the first time in many, many years, on the American campuses at least, that students are more receptive than they ever have been to the message of the gospel. I find this as part of the general idealism, and a lot of, despite the despair and the anger about the war, the racism, things like that, there's also a genuine speak of hope and I think of optimism in a lot of the student movement. And even though a lot of it is not directed in the channel of the organized church, because a lot of them have simply given up on the church already, because they figure it has had a long time to prove what it can do, and they don't see much impact. And yet, a lot of them seem to be motivated by, if not explicit Christian motivation, at least certainly by things which a Christian could find in the gospel message, like some of the signs that you saw on the parade. And even in the personal motivation that leads a man to decide, you know, whether I will fight the draft system on my conscience, like Martin Luther, you know, here I stand, I can't run to Canada or somewhere else, but I'll stay here and fight it. This is good Lutheran theology, too. And I would agree with you. I think there's a tremendous job just being a presence on the university campus and being a sign of hope when everybody else is in despair. and saying, there is a future, there is hope for your future, and let me share it with you. And, you know, and it's not maybe the old style of evangelism where you grab them into an organized, even an organized campus church, but simply that by being a creative Christian where you are, your light does shine. And I think there's a tremendous opportunity right now, even within perhaps some of the student movements. One of the things which several of us at Stanford did was when the going got rough and the movement sort of fell apart, when they grabbed the hall and the police came in and they were pretty much in despair about doing anything, and we figured this is a time when they need help more than simply people condemning them. And so several of us, more moderate people, tried to join these groups. And then we got acquainted with a lot of the more radical students that way. But we also had an opportunity to influence policy and at least perhaps to have some kind of dialogue and sharing going on. So there are so many ways, I think, that a person can operate within these structures yet, even when you have uncertain times like that.
I think that just a few specifics about what is being done in the present situation by Christians, even by Christian leaders, university campuses. I think particularly serving in the role of mediators when you have two forces in the university situation in disputation with each other, and communication is broken down. Sometimes Christian leaders who are somewhat on the periphery here have been able to assume a role in bringing the two conflicting groups into renewed consultation with one another, at least. And I think another thing is simply being a good listener and hearing what is really being said and not giving the impression that the official church is simply going to line up with the forces of reaction or suppression, that we have more than this is the way that the institutional church is seen in the light of history by so many. One pastor from the inner city and myself on that Memorial Day parade when Louis was going by, I didn't see him, but we took our station alongside of some men from other denominations in front of the barbed wire at the point at Bowditch and Dwight Way, which was suggested would be the danger point of the day. It was expected that perhaps some extreme militants would try to make the plunge at this point to go into the park, and of course, if this had happened, many would follow. The guards would have reacted, and you would have had bloodshed. So here's a role that we tried to perform. Of course, the very setting up also of the chapel as an emergency first aid station, I suppose that's more in the traditional role of the church in this kind of a situation.
Sylvia? Mr. Thiel, and then the next time. Yes.
Well, we have, as churches, lived off of the prophets, that were in some
think today that if American industry could suddenly abolish unions, they'd go back to a dollar a day wage. But on the other hand, the unions themselves are exploitative in the way that they don't want people of all colors to be in their membership. Everybody's doing it to everybody else. So you've got all of the uniform revolution at work right now in this city. Use the word happy before. I asked the assistant dean of Washington University about a year ago, how come St. Louis is quiet? Is it due to good communication between the races? Or does the power structure have enough influential egos in it so that they keep their people quiet? He said, no, I think it's apathy. But this apathy is not going to last. There was a book discussed today about when the use of the Sunday school in San Francisco was discussed in front of a congressional committee, a coloring book for Sunday school. This is the policeman. Color him dead. He is a pig. Read the things that Eldridge Cleaver has written. Read anything you want. They're not all dolts either. Believe me, Mr. Ray Sharp, Malcolm X, the book. This is what's talking about here. If we have done this, our forests are large. Who wants to close the dam gate so we can have a dam and sell more electricity? Not the people that are going to buy the electricity. Who wants to build 800 apartments within a mile of where I live over there? Not the landowner, not the county planning board, but a developer who can make money. And the whole area will suffer. You have 1,400 cars in 30 minutes on a two-lane road every morning. That's exploitation. What we're doing with our oil, we set our refineries. I just heard this the other day that on the shores of Chesapeake Bay, could that be when Jersey's shore, I think it's a dirty shore of the Chesapeake. Almost all of marine life within 40 miles of the ocean has been destroyed by the affluents, and that's spelled NTS, of this oil refinery. This is what we're doing, and somebody makes all the dough and everybody else, some other people go over and get another problem. Well, it's better.
You mentioned about the pollution. It makes a lot of sense. I was in Santa Barbara last summer. I was in Santa Barbara, California, on these nice beaches last summer.
Wow.
And it hurts every time I read about, you know, the oil slick. And I guess I saw a picture a few days ago. They're still trying to clean that oil off the beaches. At the time last summer, the only people who got concerned about it were a few little old ladies who set up tables on the street, and people thought they were crazy. You know, and then half a year later, the entire town is up in arms about it.
Sure.
I know.
And the church must know that she has to make that fight. Well, another one, this guy, Mary Cranberry, down on Lindholm in the last week, he refused to have it, but he called into the church and gave some reason how to sitting in
No, and I can tell the difference just coming from San Francisco, coming into St. Louis, and I ride the bus now in the morning, and I ride with all the maids coming to work in Clayton, when I come down from Del Mar and Skinker, and it's fascinating listening after some of the militants entered the churches, and listening to the people on the bus talk, and it amazed me that a lot of the black people were condemning this kind of action, you know, and saying this is terrible, and it upsets everything. That certainly was a different feeling from the coast. The last thing I remember when I left Berkeley, I was going up to visit a cousin of mine who lives up in the hills, and I saw a black man's car stalled in the street, and a white truck driver was parked behind him, and the white man was honking his horn. And the black man simply got out of his car, the most dignified expression I've ever seen, and simply walked up to that truck, shook his fist in the man's face, you know, and just said very calmly, "You stop honking that damn horn," he said, "because I am not going to move. I can't move. You just go around me." But I thought symbolically, that kind of action, I thought it indicated something.
I really appreciate the way you have dramatized some of the glaring examples of causes, I think, of the student discontent and the sort of thing that people are reacting to in this country. I wonder if I can just take a moment to bring another thought in here, which I hope is vital. It seems to me that coming back to this question of how can we minister in this situation, what can the Christian presence mean here, it's my impression that Lutherans generally are, their immediate or natural inclination in all of this is to react by coming down real hard on the side of law and order. And I, presuming that Minneapolis is a very Lutheran city and what took place in the election there may indicate that this is where some of the Lutheran electorate stand. Now, it seems to me that the real problem is how can we get off of this to the point that we can show a genuine sympathy and concern with the plight of the oppressed and with the cause of justice that is represented here, and at the same time be able to speak a prophetic word to those who are advocating revolution, that is, pointing up what the high price of revolution really is and how the tremendous chances you are taking that you may end up with a kind of chaos and anarchy that may bring immense bloodshed and suffering to whole sections of humanity. It may be an enormous price that is paid, and your own revolutionary movements may be subject to new types of corruption. This Christian insight into the inevitable, invariable perversity of man and how this spreads into the movement. But how do you say this, you see, to these very idealistic-minded people who are, the moment you begin to do this, you are in danger of giving the impression that you are really on the side of reaction and you are opposed to the cause of justice. Sure. I should mention one of our students asked to look at the Book of Memorials for the Denver Convention, and his reaction was he was utterly appalled. He was utterly aghast. He said, this is incredible that a church in 1969 can have this as the focus of almost his total attention, and the issues which many of them, and these are Lutherans too, out in this area, feel ought to have top priority are, as you indicate, barely mentioned, if at all.
I might say that is, of course, and I think this is another answer to the what are we doing now. I think many of us are just continuing to do what we feel is right, you know, continuing to plan, continuing to be involved in schools and all these things. I think the challenge, though, is to our society, and that's what Ralph was alluding to, that these had better start to become priorities for us, because those of us who continue to work on these things are going to have to show some kind of success one of these years, you know, for what we've been doing, and not that I've been doing that much, but I mean the people who are really, really intimately, because I think, at least thinking of the ghetto, and that no one, if you were to go and talk in any ghettos, the only people talking revolution are, you know, a very small percentage. They still have this deep down belief, and I think partly it's Christian belief and hope that they will achieve in peaceful, law-abiding ways. And I think to get from this the idea that all of, you know, at least the ghetto is bubbling and ready to splatter all over the map is just not true. But the more deceit that they have, the more we are losing the battle. Now, this year in New York City, we had a whole space. It got to be almost every single school that was racially mixed was having uproar, and they had to suspend classes. Well, one of our sociologists linked this very directly to the teacher's strike. All these years, Negroes have been teaching their kids to respect teachers. That's not happening anymore. The first thing that the teachers came back to their kids, the kids said, "Why weren't you here the last 2 months teaching us?" They didn't say, "I'm going to shoot you." They said, "Why weren't you teaching us the last 2 months?" And I'm just saying that it seems to me that our whole society at this juncture is going not in the direction of solving, but in the opposite direction.
I think I'd like to add to that. Maybe one of the greatest things a Christian can do is not to be afraid. And at least, despite the fact that you are afraid all the time inside, I think the Christian can be the one person in a community that is polarized or that is fearful, and that runs to the law and order people. Christian can be the one person who at least tries to show that he has something more than simply a policeman's club to fall back upon. And that maybe this kind of presence and this kind of witness will say something louder than all the preaching he could do in another way. And I think as an example of the fact, if you do give people small victories and you give them hope, and you continue to give them hope, then perhaps a lot of the violence can be avoided. I think back at Stanford this spring, we had a rough situation when the black students became so frustrated, they went into the bookstore and they did about $1,000 worth of damage, breaking windows, knocking some of the books off, and I felt very sad, you know, seeing these books lying there. And then you start thinking, though, how can you ever account for broken spirits and people who have been trampled on inside through years and years of in the classroom and outside? And out of that, they finally got some money for a black drama group that Johnny Scott and some of the other people had wanted for a long time. They gave three plays this spring. They had about 70 people from the community working on it. The interesting thing is, this is the first time in years Stanford has had any effective relationship with the surrounding community, because they went into East Palo Alto and got some of the other black kids there to help them out. They indicated on the backside of their program that they regretted the fact that it took a confrontation like the bookstore incident in order to pry loose enough money from the administration to do what they had wanted to do for a year or two before, namely to get some kind of theater group going where they could identify with and that they could be proud of to call their own. And they had a tremendous production, and they're going around to high schools in the area, all over the Bay, to the East Bay. And I think they have something there. It's giving a lot of these students a chance to act and to write and to do things creatively. I think a lot of people like Johnny Scott are going to be heard from. I think he'll be one of the great American novelists someday. Newsweek recently indicated that probably the next flowering of American literature will be after the Jewish Renaissance of the 1950s and 60s, the black novelists of the 1970s. And things like this can give hope. I think historically the thing that bothers me is you most seem to have revolutions coming not when people are entirely down, but when you have an upturn and you have hope that has been generated, and then suddenly the money is cut off or simply it isn't followed through. And this is what frightens me about our priorities on our budget. And you have $80 billion going into weapons in Vietnam and things like that, and here the poverty programs in the cities just stagnate, and the city mayors are practically giving up in despair now of even being able to handle the cities. And I just read in the new Newsweek or Time that I guess Vice President Agnew is supposed to be in charge of cities now. Most of the mayors have no confidence or even respect for him. And it's almost like a cold war now between the administration and the mayors of the large cities. And unless I remember the sign on one of these student things, reverse our priorities. And I think this is the thing that bothers me dreadfully. This is why I sort of share Dr. Thiel's concern about the convention. That's the best we can do for a convention at this time. I don't know if we can offer anything to these young people who are concerned about these problems.
Sorry, I passed you by before. You have the floor. Yes.
I can't get uptight about convention maybe because I've been in 10 years and I've been to the convention official for this reason, that reason. And I've seen resolutions implemented in convention for a period of time that don't really have really filtered down, so I say. But the reason I want to floor is I hear you, I'm trying to hear you anyway, you know, what you think. I'm trying to hear what the kids in the campuses around are saying, and the kids down in Chicago. The black community and the Spanish Americans sort of run with a little bit anyway. I'm trying to hear what they're saying. But I have a problem. I'm a parish pastor in far, far west, trying to connect the suburbs of Chicago, in a predominantly German Swedish community. Now, my thing is not really what convention says, because I'm not a delegate. Really, where you're at, that's where you're at, but where I'm at, I need help. I mean, now, what do we do? What do I do? I can be dismissed as a rather my idiosyncrasies by the people and things I say. I've tried to understand, and I find myself invariably drawn into a position of, not defense, but saying why these things are going on. Most of the members are pretty good. They're willing to excuse me because I'm young or something or other. But I got to know, how can I reach them? Because what disturbs me most is when Jesus for Christ, when, you know, the thing goes on. This is tokenism. All right. You know, you go to the youth group and talk. Here, I thought the youth group was gone from home. I mean, youth are idealistic, but they're not. They're receiving the same thing their parents have been telling me Bible plans for the last year. And I got a problem because we're perpetuating in my community something. What can, you suggest, or what can we do here to correct something that will perpetuate in my community the same thing? And within the next generation, they're going to have the same hang-ups we have now. These kids will not contribute to it outside of one guy who went off to college, dropped a full scholarship, went out to California, traveled around for the year, He's the guy who knows, whole congregation's down on his parents are heartbroken. Now he's back at college. It was a good experience for him to see, but in our community, you don't drop out of society and you don't be what is called, a hippie. And this is the thing, is there any suggestions or any help? Or are people going to work on it in a community where they've got to be reached? And I think that's predominantly where most of our churches are and where our church as a group begins to speak from, this closed type community that has no outreach and you can't seem to reach the people.
I think you've expressed the problem very well, which I assume faces most of the parish serving clergy in the Missouri Synod. And I think inescapably you have a tremendous problem, and I see no easy solution for it. For one thing, we simply have inherited our whole past here, which has largely been one of silence and a reluctance to address ourselves to issues of this sort, and now to suddenly do so or to come with a big blast in your congregation, as you indicate, would simply splinter everything and perhaps destroy the effectiveness of any potential ministry you might have. I hope your parish is not as badly off as one that I addressed in California, where I gained the impression that their understanding of Christianity was primarily in terms of defense of private property rights and the American way of life. Now, I think if somehow these illusions have been built up among a good part of our constituency, and I think we have to pierce these illusions and begin to communicate what valid theology is applicable to the crises of our time, but I don't think it's something you can probably do overnight. But even if you get at it and you begin, I think you're inevitably going to face some tensions. And I know a number of men that I would regard as top-notch parish pastors in our district, and they have been daring enough to witness to their convictions in relation to something like the war or racism, and they have suffered for it. Yet their congregations have not collapsed. They've been able to continue their ministry. I don't know if this helps.
I can respond to it.
Please.
I wonder if it helps to humanize a problem like that by maybe bringing people into contact with other people who are facing some of these problems in society. And that would mean either bringing people from the ghetto or facilitating. I mean, it seems maybe old-fashioned to argue this way at this stage of the game, and yet I still think there are a lot of opportunities that can be taken here, either to talk to people and to set up situations where you have forays into problem areas, or bringing people who are on the line into small groups, where you can have small group encounters. It struck me out on the coast that I have some catalogs from the Free University, if any of you are interested in looking through it. It's fascinating to look at all the different things on how people get along with one another, and on communication, and things like feeling and sensitivity to other people, the kind of thing that Esalen Society does. And I wonder more and more after seeing this in action and seeing the fact that a lot of the student movement at Stanford was carried on by what they called affinity groups, which would be small groups of people that met in a circle on the grass and simply sat and started talking out these problems. These were the most effective and constructive parts of the entire protest business. And I saw a lot of opportunity here, that things that people in the church maybe could learn to do, where you maybe getting in a circle and start talking. Maybe it could be in a member's home, or maybe it could be at some kind of a meeting to make it more than just simply a presentation type thing. And then starting on the dialogue idea and trying to build that up and going beyond the talking stage to where you work with a human problem, and maybe by dealing in concrete terms with people who are facing problems like that instead of just an abstract problem, maybe this is one approach. I can't speak with any authority here because I'm not out in the parish situation.
Three men asking for the floor. We're approaching the hour of 9:30, which was the suggested adjournment time. I think our tape would run longer than that. I don't know whether your patience will, but I should feel free to say to you that if any of you would like to leave, you would do that without embarrassing the discussion. Dean Wagner and Pastor Radice and President Fierbringer, please.
Well, I'm going to come back to the question I asked before, and I was asking it out of a sense of frustration. It's related to this whole question of why aren't we as a church doing more in this area? Why doesn't the Denver Convention have these things on the agenda? For yesterday, for 12 hours, they had a roaring toothache. And finally, about 3:30, I kind of went into the dentist and spent an hour there. And I couldn't figure out after I left there whether it continued to hurt because he hadn't got the right tooth or because he had messed things up worse. But it's still going on. I'm going back tomorrow. I don't need anybody to tell me. I've got to go there and get something done about it, see? It is very real to me. But we as a church don't feel the toothache in our society. We don't feel that this cancer just eating us up. So why? Why haven't we as a church made this claim? Why can't... criticize you. Why can't you, fellas, say this to us now in a way that's going to just grab us and make us go out and do something about it? That was the point of my question to you before, Jim. Why do you want to exercise this Christian presence? What motivates you? You know, what do you want to do? How could you explain, if this were a committee of the Denver Convention, how could you explain to them that this is their concern and that they've got to invest time and talent themselves in the amelioration of all these problems, including that two things?
Well, he's thinking, how about the New Testament sense of eschatological urgency, the
I'm with you, Ralph. I guess
theology of hope. Now, I'll throw this back to you. I mean, now I would assume that some of you theologians sitting here are better equipped to do this than we are. You're all familiar with this, but it seems to me that perhaps here is one accent that in contemporary theology that we have, which takes this whole concept of resurrection, which has been traditionally used to buttress the whole idea of escapism from social responsibility, and turns it around and makes it a primary motivating force for involvement. In fact, in the dialoguing with Marxists in Czechoslovakia last October, this is the very thing that comes out. Here are these people who are willing to listen to Christians. The reason is that they have discovered that religion is not necessarily the opiate of the people. It may be a leaven in the society. This has been their experience through what some of the Czech Christians have done in Czechoslovakia. So, I don't know, maybe there's something here that we can start with.
Pastor Rudy?
Is it not so that we're not asking that for us and people at all, Christians of all time, that the meanings that the society are looking for, the meanings that individuals are seeking in the patterns they pursue, whatever these may be, that we know what meaning they are looking for. There is only one meaning, capital M, that lasts. They may be looking on the wrong way, but we know what they mean. Is it not that the Christian has to identify with the person to pursue, search for meaning? He has to hear it, rightly understand what it is, and so he's in tune with the search. And only therein can he be a part of that search, which, of course, is near enough. Refer beyond that hope, the little hope, the little meaningful things we do, to him who is the hope. And in that act, be token then. He who is the end of all. I was sitting at the table and someone said, pass the butter, this bread needs butter. Naturally, I would pass what he would hope to have in butter. I would have had some food. But isn't it that every concrete pursuit that we share with other people is, by God's own act in us, to betoken them far more than just a piece of creative order that we could misuse on our own? Because he who involves us reflects who all we are, not just the act, the passing of the fire, which would do an active sharing the mouth, but also through our words, within the whole of ourselves, to give meaning, the final hope, the real one for whom in all things fit together.
I think that's beautiful, the way you've expressed that. One of the real joys that I had at Stanford in the last 2 years is to see how professors like Dr. Spitz, whom I worked with, are able to get through to people, and how students appreciate the fact that you have somebody who is able to listen and to be a counselor. I think one of the things you find on a campus like that is you don't want a professor that you can just simply talk about your specialty or to talk about these deep intellectual matters, but you want somebody who can be a human being to you. There's a beautiful article in the February 1968 issue of Motive magazine on that very thing about the teacher and the student. I think this is one of the things that keeps driving me into maybe university teaching someday. I see how Dr. Spitz can do it, and you have a steady stream of people outside of your office who aren't even connected with your courses. Something to talk about. Should I go to graduate school next year? What should I do about the draft that I have staring me in the face? What should I do about this marriage problem? It's almost like you're a pastoral counselor in a structure like that, and you by your very manner, the way you lecture, the way you act, the fact that you have a smile and crack jokes, sort of indicates in a lot of ways that you have a hope. And you share this hope with your people in so many different ways, by being out maybe at a point of, like on a picket line, or at a point where you have a student confrontation of sorts. And in various ways, you indicate that there is a hope for your future. And I think there are a lot of ways a person can share this, whether on a campus or even in a parish, in a community. The problem then is to translate that hope, I think, into concrete action, as well as simply into words.
Mr. Moderator, may I excuse myself? I have another commitment. No one has offended me. And may, as I just in departing, express my own appreciation for the opportunity and the interaction that we've been able to have.
All right. Thank you. Time to adjourn?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you all, panelists and group.